Costs to originate keep rising, even with more technology in the industry. The problem is the core platform. A new LOS can re-architect the process around data, not humans moving paper files. Vesta has built this LOS, and you can learn more at vesta.com.
Welcome, everyone. I'm Sarah Wheeler, Editor-in-Chief at HW Media, with the latest installment of the Housing Wire Daily podcast, where our editors and reporters discuss the most compelling stories and sources they're covering. Today, my guest is HousingWire senior mortgage reporter Georgia Cromry, who covers the federal beat, including the FHFA, Fannie and Freddie, the CFPB, and more. Before we jump in, here's a word from our sponsor.
This episode is sponsored by First Guarantee Mortgage Corporation. When you work with FGMC, you're more than a customer, you're a partner. From monthly webinars and trainings to our non-QM structure desk, our mortgage mavericks make it easy for you to be successful. We're standing by to confirm eligibility, help calculate bank statements and DTI, and evaluate credit. Reach out today. Maverick Solutions products are available through wholesale and non-delegated delivery. To access our partner resources or to submit a non-QM scenario, visit fgmc.com/maverick. First Guarantee Mortgage Corporation, NMLS ID 2917, 5800 Tennyson Parkway, Suite 450, Plano, Texas, 75024.
Georgia, welcome back to the podcast.
Hey, thanks, Sarah.
So glad to have you on. So you have been reporting on the duty to serve plans that Fannie and Freddie submitted to the FHFA, which the FHFA rejected, but in a weird bureaucratic twist, they're actually still operating on at the moment.
This week,
it's very strange, right? But this week, the news was a collective of 19 housing groups called, they call themselves the Underserved Mortgage Markets Coalition, made recommendations for what the new plans should look like. So could you talk a little bit about what they are calling for?
Yeah. Well, first of all, the duty to serve process, it isn't like a public process in the way that some other things that the FHFA and Fannie and Freddie do. So it's not like there's a public comment process and feedback and then rulemaking. It's just duty to serve is a program that Fannie and Freddie work out with FHFA. So it's interesting, like this coalition is kind of making the process a little bit more public in the sense that they're kind of putting one version, one possibility, something that, you know, a version of the plans that they would like out there. And Fannie and Freddie now have this plan. FHFA has this plan. And so, you know, really whatever Fannie and Freddie come up with and FHFA eventually reviews and approves will, you know, to some extent kind of be judged by this plan that's already out here. So it's really interesting. It's an interesting strategy. And yeah, what I can say about the plan, what stood out to me is that it would significantly raise the targets for manufactured housing loans, like by a lot. Like for Fannie Mae, it would double the target for manufactured housing loan purchases. For Freddie Mac, it would, you know, by 2024, it would triple it, nearly triple it. So that is a lot. I don't think I can say if it's a lot relative to the market. I think that's a different question, but it's certainly like dramatic compared to the plans that we have seen from Fannie Mae and Freddie Mac, which they, you know, you remember they proposed those plans back last May. And so they would have worked on those originally proposed plans with the previous FHFA director. And, you know, that kind of went through a long process with FHFA before they, you know, proposed them. So it's interesting. And also on manufactured housing, so it's worth remembering that, you know, about half of the market is not secured the same way that home mortgages are. They're chattel loans. They are treated as they're secured by private property. It's closer to like an auto loan or, you know, other kinds of loan products. They typically have higher interest rates. They have fewer consumer protections. But again, this is like nearly half the market. So it's a substantial amount of the market that is chattel loans. And Fannie Mae and Freddie Mac both had done a lot of work leading up to 2019 to look at whether they should purchase chattel loans. FHA and the VA, they already do financing for chattel loans, but the GSEs do not. And so they had quite extensive plans to do pilot programs to get into chattel loans. But they those plans were kind of abruptly scrapped in early, well, in 2019. But we found out about it in early 2020 when the FHFA kind of, this was early 2020, FHFA said in their annual report that the enterprises both kind of killed their own efforts by submitting infeasibility requests. And so we don't know why those efforts were shut down or kind of what, you know, what happened there, but because there wasn't any rationale given. But this coalition calls for rebooting of those efforts to launch pilot programs for chattel loans, which would be really interesting.
It really would be. And, you know, duty to serve is, I'm sure as most people in our industry know, it's really duty to serve the, you know, low to moderate income borrowers. So it's people who don't qualify for some of the, you know, for the regular things that, that Fannie and Freddie, securitize. So I think it's a really interesting part. Another part for me was when it once said they wanted to, expand the kind of products that they offer, you know, to have more flexibility in the loan products that they offer for rural or low income people. So I thought that was interesting to offer flexible loan products for low to moderate income borrowers in high need rural areas, which we know is a huge part of the duty to serve.
Right. So duty to serve is for manufactured housing, affordable housing, preservation, and rural housing. So yeah, there could be there could possibly be some really innovative products that come out of this. And of course, the GSEs right now are in a revision process already with FHFA, and we're not really sure what the status of that or how that's shaping up. But I have to think that that now they're like, they're at least this is out there. This is maybe part of that conversation. So yeah, it will, it remains to be seen how that shakes out.
Another story that you covered this week was the fact that regulators, state regulators, slapped mortgage LOs with fines. And, you know, the headline I thought was great was regulators slapped mortgage LOs with fines for skipping class. But it literally is for skipping class. It's they had continuing education requirements. And this company apparently set up an entire, like, false, you know, continuing ed program that that LOs from across the industry signed up for and didn't really have to do. And it was a 1 8-hour class, I think. Is that correct?
Yeah, that's right. So it was continuing education, although, you know, I was kind of poking around what the offerings of this, this place is out of California, real estate educational services run by Danny Yen. You know, they offer a lot of classes, like one of them is for fair housing. And it, you know, I'm not sure how much credit a 3-hour online course gives, but you can get a, 3-hour online course in fair housing for $19. From real estate educational services. I don't recommend it, just based on this regulatory.
Right.
but anyway, yeah, it's interesting. I mean, it caught up a lot of LOs across the country. I think LOs in every state. And so state regulators settled with 400 something of these LOs, but they identified more than 600 LOs that were caught up in this scheme. And so, you know, the way it worked was an LO would have paid real estate educational services, Danny Yen in California, for these online classes to fulfill their licensure requirements. And Danny Yen either did the classes for them and submitted on their behalf or just gave them credit, depending. And, you know, didn't require them to come to class or anything like that. You could imagine something like that happening. Maybe, you know, I was thinking to myself, well, if Danny Yen and his, if his firm was licensed to give educational programs, but then COVID happened and they went online and they, you know, had some hiccups in the process, you could imagine how something like that might've happened. But this is, this is not, apparently what was going on. This had been going on for quite some time and quite some time before COVID as well. So this is not a case of a COVID misstep, I would say.
Well, and it's not the case of like LOs who weren't, didn't understand exactly how this worked, right? Or at least it's not the same as, I mean, they know every year, okay, I have to have this for my NMLS, you know, license. So they know that that's happening, but it's not just like, oh, I missed it. It's like, I signed up for something that someone else took for me. Like, I didn't go through the process. I think the thing that stuck out for me is just, it was a pretty hefty, it's not that the fine is so much, it's the fact that then they're suspended for, they have to have a cooling off period of what, 3 months?
Yeah, so 3 months, that's got to hurt. And they also have to pay $1,000 fine for every state they're licensed in. So, you know, I'm sure for LOs that are in, you know, Texas or California, they're probably only licensed in Texas or California. But in New England, for example, it's quite typical to be licensed in several small states that are nearby. So, so that's got to hurt. And the 3 month cooling off period. I thought it was interesting though, that the lenders and the firms that employed these LOs were not fined at all. They were not part of the enforcement action at all. They were not even named, but apparently it was a diverse group of companies. It wasn't any one market segment or size of lender, but you have to, I'm not sure what kind of, you know, if you're a lender and looking at this, like what kind of diligencing are you going to do if your employee has a valid license? You're not going to be asking them about why that license is valid or what did they do to make that license valid. You have a valid license, so you sort of don't worry about it. But this does raise questions. I suppose you can spend as much time on compliance risk as you want to.
Well, especially because they would have, to your point, I mean, you know, your compliance department is like, I'm sure, you know, every year it's like, okay, you need to file this. We need to, you know, confirm that your license is in good standing, whatever. But, right. You know, right. You have to trust them as professionals to do this. And I do.
There has to be some sort of trust element, right? Yeah. But, you know, this might make lenders think of better practices, like, you know, why not suggest a class or purchase a block of classes as a perk for your loan officers and get a good rate for everybody or something like that would probably be a good idea in light of this. But
The thing that I thought was like, okay, so we're in an environment where lenders are shedding staff. Well, if you have a mandatory cooling off period where you can't originate loans, I mean, don't you have a target on your back? Why would they keep you at this point, right?
Yeah, probably. That's a good question. Yeah, I'm not sure, but that's I'm sure some lenders are thinking that. And I would have loved to be able to see kind of are there specific companies where, you know, a dozen of their LOs were caught up in this or is this really just scattershot? We don't have access to that, but it would be interesting to see kind of what companies and if there was anything in their practices that made their LOs a little bit more vulnerable to something like this.
I just thought it was a fascinating story. It just continues to show, you know, the regulatory nature that we're in, but also the fact that it was concentrated in one company made it then easy for them once whoever took them off, however they got the information, once they started looking, then all of the people, it made it easy to find, I would think, as opposed to like...
That's true. Yeah. Yeah. The one thing they all had in common was this small educational firm in Carlsbad, California. It's not like they did a statistical analysis, a regression of LO performance, and then figured out that they had fallen short on their continuing education.
That's what I thought at first when I saw the headline. I was like, oh my gosh, talk about regulation down to the level, like they're going.
No, I think it's actually a really important detail is that the regulators said that the loans were valid. There is nothing wrong with the loans that these loan officers did. I imagine some of them, the GSEs must have thought there is no action going to be taken with those loans. They are valid if they were closed. Now the loans that the loan officers have in their pipelines, that's a different story. They sort of said, well, lenders should reach out to us and see what to do about those loans while they're in their cooling off period. So that might be a bit tricky, but yeah, it was purely because they all had in common this one Carlsbad, California-based firm.
It's just wild to me, and to your point, like if you're a company and you're like, seriously, really, all you had to do was take an 8-hour class and crazy. And well, let's switch topics a little bit and talk about the desktop appraisal option is going to start in March. You know, you've done a lot of reporting on this. So tell us what happened this week with desktop appraisals.
Yeah, so this is very exciting for, I think if you're an appraiser, this is exciting. If you're a lender, this is very exciting because, you know, we know that appraisal times are really long right now, and anything that can kind of speed that process is really, really exciting. So this will be for some purchase loans starting after March 19th. So this has been expected for a while. And since Sandra Thompson announced in October at MBA that they were going to make desktop appraisals permanent. So this is something that was originally rolled out as a temporary flexibility in the early days of the pandemic. I think everyone knows that. And it sort of gave FHFA a chance to kind of run or the GSEs as well, a chance to kind of run a natural experiment, right? Like they used this, I think in April, this was by April 2020, this was like a huge share of loans were being done remotely like this. And so letting this be a permanent measure now is everyone is really, really excited. Yeah.
Well, and it's a huge topic of conversation among appraisers. So we had a lunch and learn last week about it. And I always get really mixed reviews after I either write about it. I used to do ed notes about this after the lunch and learn. You know, I invited people to let me know what they thought. And you do have appraisers who are excited about it, and then you have appraisers who are not excited about it because they do feel like, you know, there's some of this that takes away from the in-person expertise that they have. But to your point, it's clearly what they saw when they looked at the loans is that those loans did not perform worse. In other words, the value that was gotten from desktop appraisals over that time frame, those loans didn't end up falling out because actually, you know, for whatever reason, but the property valuation was wrong, for instance. So seeing that they did well, then that just bolstered the whole program, right?
Right, right. And that's because they got to do this natural experiment because of COVID. I just want to make sure we're clear. Desktop appraisals are not exactly the same thing as hybrid appraisals, or I think some people call them bifurcated appraisals. So desktop appraisals are based on property tax records and past sales, but you know, the key difference, of course, is they don't have the physical inspection. So it means someone is sitting at a desk and getting information and doing research, but no one is going and going and doing a physical walkthrough. So there are a number of potential benefits from that FHFA has pointed out. So they did a request for input, request for information about this. And they thought that, you know, potentially not having the physical walkthrough would mean that maybe some bias in the process could be avoided. That's a hot topic right now, obviously. And you know, I was talking to an appraiser yesterday who was involved with the Appraisal Diversity Initiative, which Fannie Mae and Freddie Mac are both sponsoring with the National Urban League. I think the Appraisal Institute as well. They seem to think that desktop appraisals will be somewhat of a benefit for recruiting new appraisers. I don't know how attractive as a career path being an appraiser is if you think that, you know, most of your day you're going to spend in a car driving from place to place. You know, it sounds the way appraisers are often described is as a lone wolf, you know, and that's maybe not the most attractive career. This person was telling me for a young person that might be interested in being an appraiser, it might be much more attractive if there's, you know, they're sitting in an office environment, they're using technology, it's, you know, a little bit more you know, it sounds maybe a little bit more fun.
Well, and
so they were excited about that,
especially for rural areas, which we've already just discussed. That's why you have wait times in rural areas. So they're so long because someone has to be able to physically get there. And, you know, you may not have a lot of appraisers in the area anyway, but like, you know, how many can they do in a day if they're widespread, if they're geographically far apart? So you can see how that does really, the desktop appraisal part probably impacts rural appraisals even more than others.
Right, right. I mean, you have to think that they spend a lot of their time just in the car. And that doesn't, I mean, you know, that's just the way it is. And that's why they have longer wait times and some rural appraisals are much more expensive. But I think for recruiting and trying to deal with the industry's both age issue and demographics issue, it's not great. So I think everyone I've talked to is pretty excited about desktop appraisals. I think the holdouts, I think change is hard. And so I think there is a little bit of reticence there that makes sense. But a lot of people are excited about this.
Yeah, no, I think so too. I also think, you know, it's just the bias of like the people who reach out sometimes are the people who are really unhappy. We know that, right? As a media
strong opinion, yes.
The people you hear from are not necessarily representative of a whole. It's just the, you know, the people you hear of, the people you hear from, the highest proportion of those people are unhappy. That's what I would say. Expletive filled emails is what I could forward. But I agree with you. And I think one of the after effects of the having that refi boom is you had so many properties in the U.S. now have been refied, had an appraisal done. So you have a recent appraisal on all of these properties. And
right.
You know, what does that mean going forward? You have more data, you have a recent property valuation that you can base things off of. So there's a lot of reasons why I think the desktop appraisal now makes sense.
And it's not for all. It's not for all transactions with the PSEs. So I don't know. I actually don't know where Freddie Mac is on this yet. This was an announcement from Fannie Mae. So FHFA said in October they were going to do this, you know, starting early in the year. And now we've heard from Fannie Mae, and now we have a date. But it's not going to be for all transactions. It won't be for second homes or cash out refis, no construction loans, no investment properties, manufactured homes are a no-go, condos, co-ops, renovation loans. Did I miss anything? No, I think that's everything. So there are a lot of, transactions for which this will not apply. And then also there's a loan to value ratio floor. So this is not like, I would say to people that are a little bit worried about this being, you know, a huge change. Yes, it is. Yes, it is a big change. Yes, it is. You know, it's important, but it's not going to be every single transaction that goes through both Fannie Mae and Freddie Mac.
That's correct. And they really, you know, they're trying to, you know, they look at it from a risk perspective. What is it that is, you know, you can trade on the risk on that it's, you know, there are a lot of these loans that just you could do from a desktop appraisal and then there are a lot you can't. So that's a great point. The last topic I wanted to get to, this is not a story that you covered, although I know that you did some editing on it. And that is that Vishal Garg, the CEO of Better.com, is back. So this is an interesting story, right? Because the CEO of Better.com, a month ago, he was forced to take administrative leave because he was on a pretty infamous call now, a Zoom call where he fired 900 team members, right? And in a way that was seen as very lacking empathy, and then, you know, went on to tell the remaining staff that they were lazy and some other things, stealing from his time or, you know, stealing from the company by not working hard. So, you know, just a really interesting story, but also, I would say that, you know, the company was about to go public. They were scheduled to go public in the fourth quarter, pushed that back as a result. So, anyway, but apparently he's back from administrative leave.
Yeah, I mean, he took a really short timeout. And it makes me wonder if there were problems, more with kind of the way he delivered the news and the way he, you know, maybe his tone or the way he conducted himself. And I think certainly like the media, attention that they got after he, made that after he did that infamous Zoom, I think was really unwelcome, but I don't think there was necessarily a problem with the content of what he did. So it's sort of, this sends a signal that, they're supportive of him, which is kind of surprising. And I'm not sure what the strategy is there, but yeah. And I also wonder what message does this send? If you're an LO at, Better right now, like what message does this send? It's like, you know, your boss was put on a really, you know, really short timeout, really doesn't have a whole lot of his punishment did not have teeth at all. So I wonder kind of if this is leading to some more natural attrition. If so, please reach out to me. If you have opinions about this at better.com and you're thinking about leaving or know of people leaving, please reach out to me.
I think the interesting thing is they had three of their top execs leave. I mean, who left in the wake of this, and then two of their board members resigned, right?
That's
so
right.
It's interesting that they're bringing him back, you know, and of course the going public part is a big part of that. You don't know what, you know, what that looks like. But I think one of the things that stood out to me is that the company had a review of the company culture, and it's going to implement a company-wide training program on ensuring a respectful workplace. But from my perspective, if I work there, I'm like, well, I don't think that anyone has said the rank and file or the employees are creating a non-respectful workplace. It seems to be pretty targeted at the top. So I can imagine, as you said, like if you're an LO there, not only is that discouraging because, you know, I mean, everybody knows your company is in the news for a reason that is unfortunate. It's not as, you know, it's not terrible. It's not like there's a lot of other things that could have happened, but then you're like, you know, do I really need to go through a company-wide training program, or is it really the person, does Vishal need to go through that? Does the CEO need to go through a training program? So I just think that's interesting. It's definitely, you know, it's what they have to do, right? It's kind of the expected thing. Okay.
Yeah.
We have to improve the
But they're sending a signal. They're sending a strong signal. And I am sure that, that, you know, some people at the company are going to decide that there's someplace better to work.
Yeah. And to your point, I mean, it's not like layoffs are new, and we will see more of those. As rates rise. So that was some of the news this week.
What? Yeah. Layoffs. I mean, yeah, margins are compressing. And so you're going to see layoffs, but I think top producing LOs have choices, you know, so if you kind of got by just on refis, I think, you know, this is a bit of a scary time right now, but if you're a top producing LO with a, you know, with an incredible pipeline and, you know, you have a well-established niche and you're good at your job, I think you have choices. So I don't think it's that the danger at Better is that a bunch of LOs are going to leave en masse, but maybe they will lose some of their top performers. That, I don't know. That's just an idea of mine. That is just speculation.
Yeah, no. And I agree that, I mean, this whole thing that we're talking about, we don't work at Better, and, you know, we're reporting on what has gone on there, but I just think that it's an interesting time, and we're going to see layoffs. So I think if I'm in the industry, what it says to me as an executive is that it's how you do it. It's how you approach it. And, you know, obviously he did it right for the holidays and, you know, it was the way it was delivered. So interesting times. We have so much going on in your beat, Georgia. I appreciate you taking the time to talk about some of these top stories. And I always love having you on.
My pleasure. Thanks, Sarah.
Thank you so much. And we'll talk to you later.
Looking for more insight into what will happen in 2022? Or maybe you need more information on what in the world is happening with the federal regulators. Or you could just be looking for information on how to stay competitive as the industry shifts to a purchase-focused market. Our HW Plus Premium membership comes with all of this insight and more. With your HW Plus membership, you'll get at least 5 HW Plus articles a week that dive deeper into the daily news to help you confidently make business decisions. To join, go to housingwire.com/membership.
Thanks for listening to Housing Wire Daily. I hope you have a great weekend. If you haven't already, make sure to hit that subscribe button so you don't miss out on all the hottest stories crossing our news desk each and every day. The podcast is now available wherever you like to listen. We'll see you back here on Monday.